Loyal Opposition by Koufax, a sequel to A Large Range of Probabilities, rated PG, read by Love Platinum Baby, for Podfic Lovers' sweet charity bid. Summary: not everyone agrees with the Winchester algebra. Couple times a week, Sean would drive up to that parcel on the north side of Kornfelder's place and scout around under the high-tension wires, checking for monsters, werewolves, or ghouls, just to be sure. Often enough, she'd find another car parked along the road, usually a truck or a car with empty bike racks on the top. The mountain bikers loved the swooping trails and rough country under the power lines. She hated to see them there, because she couldn't carry the Remington openly out of season, and she was never comfortable here unarmed. Not to mention that one of these days, one of those civilians was going to get it, as Canthy would have said, and there would be hell to pay. On a wet Tuesday in late October, though, it was a surprise to find a dirty black sedan filling her usual parking spot. She grunted, and Boris waffled back from the passenger seat. He was the chattiest dog she'd ever known, as she pulled in further up the road. Boris at her side, and the shotgun over her shoulder, she walked casually back to the sedan, and from there into the woods. It had stopped raining about an hour ago, but the wet leaves dripped on her face and jacket, and mud slicked up in the soles of her boots. She'd have to hose Boris down before letting him in the house when she got home, which was always fun. But she'd learned better than to leave him behind since the time last year when she met up with what was probably a black dog. Now that had been an ugly job, and she was lucky to have just one scar to show for it. She learned her lesson, though, which was one reason she was still hunting nearly 20 years on. You didn't have to tell Lashandra Mason anything twice. So now she took Boris everywhere, and if Mike, yeah, Canthy's nephew, and hadn't she given Sean an earful when they started up, didn't like the way Boris stole the covers, that was tough. Sean slowed just as she came into an open space, because there was someone standing where the trail from the road petered out into a dozen narrow might-have-beens in the dying grass and pricker bushes. It was a very tall, broad-shouldered white guy in a sopping cloth jacket, his wet, dark hair plastered to the back of his head. Whoever he was, he'd been there for a while, and he was even bigger than Evan Batiste, who slung hash at Marie's Diner. She hesitated, but, well, it was open land. Boris didn't seem worried, and there wasn't a man in the country she couldn't either take down or outrun, or take down long enough to outrun. So Sean slapped her thigh to bring Boris closer in, and when the guy jerked and swung around, she said, "Hi," with a casual wave. He wasn't a kid. Looked like he was in his 20s, with that shaggy hair, but he was grubby, the way you get with too much travel and not enough hot water. Reminded her some of the men on the street in Manchester, when she'd gone down to buy supplies she couldn't get locally. Men with no future, eyes dull and clothes of no color. "Hey," he said, glaze flickering from her to the shotgun to Boris. "Wet day for pheasants." "You never know," she replied, letting her left shoulder rise and fall. Boris settled down to sit on her boots, tail curled around Sean's heels like a big gray cat. "True," said the guy, but his voice was flat. His hands were jammed in his pockets, the cloth bulging as if he had apples clutched in his fist. He started to turn away, then stopped, forehead wrinkling. You come here often?" Sean snorted. She had to have a dozen years on him, and he winced, coloring. "Sorry, that wasn't..." "I got it," she said, and lowered the shotgun so the barrel pointed at the ground. "I come here often enough. It's a good place for the dogs. Why?" The car back at the trailhead didn't have New Hampshire plates, as Sean recalled, and they were far off the tourist routes. "You ever see anything weird?" Now that made her skin prickle. 12 years Sean hunted with Canthy, and 7 on her own now, and maybe 5 times in all those years had she met someone who knew the truth about the world. That things that went bump in the night could eat you as soon as look at you, and fire and salt and cold iron could save your life, and maybe your soul. Even the ones who ought to know, 'cause they'd seen it, most of them learned to unsee it, too. She knew there were other hunters around. Canthy had left her with 6 names and some email addresses, but Sean was too busy for that, and what were they going to be able to help with? 1,500 miles away, as most of them were. But, she thought, looking at the guy with an appraising eye, maybe they'd come to her. Yeah, she said, watching his face. Seen a lot. Killed some of it, too. He'd widened his eyes, shoulders stiffening. Killed it. She shrugged. He cocked his head, looking at her with more considerate attention. You're a hunter, he finally pronounced, as if only his stating it would make it so. Was it the shotgun that gave me away? Sean asked dryly. And yeah, you could call me that. Are you? He dug a hand into his jeans pocket for a scrap of paper. Canthi Pirelli? The name knocked her off balance. Sean couldn't hide the jerk of surprise. Funny how it hurt that empty chair at the breakfast table, the sly humor that came out best over beers after a job. Sean still couldn't believe that tumors had accomplished what 30 years of hard hunts and 50-odd years of harder winters could never. Canthi died 5 years ago, Sean said, turning her head away to look at the browning leaves of the maples across from her. I'm Lashandra, Mason. Boris whined. Canthi had chosen him from Morgan's last litter and loaded him into Sean's arms. This one's yours, Canthi had said 3 months before the end. Oh, said the guy. That's too bad that she's dead, I mean. I'm Sam Wakefield. Bobby Singer gave me her name. Sean swallowed. She wasn't going to let it get to her, not in front of a stranger. Why are you looking for her? She asks instead. I'd like to learn more about this place, how it works. He gestured at the area before them, the damp shrubs and dying grasses, birch saplings burdened with a few withering yellow-brown leaves. How it works, Sean started. Monsters show up here and cause trouble, and I kill them if I can. What the hell? Uh-huh, he nodded. But Bobby, he said he talked to your friend about it, and well, where do they come from? Boris whined again. Sean looked down and said, Recess. Boris took off at a gallop, crashing through the brush. He'd circle back in a few minutes if he didn't find something he thought she needed to hear about. The wind picked up, and when Sean looked up at the fast-moving clouds, a raindrop hit her in the eye. That's a good question, she said finally. Someplace bad, I guess. I've never seen nothing good out here. Good, said the guy, with an eagerness in his voice that startled her. I was hoping you'd say that. Monroe County still didn't have a Starbucks, although they sold the whole beans at Heath's grocery in town. The closest there was to one was Marie's on State Street, where you could get coffee regular or black, and if you were feeling adventurous, Lipton's. Wakefield was already there when Sean walked in, no surprise given how fast he drove that dinosaur of a car. Sitting in the rear booth with his back to the wall, Sean nodded to herself. Mike Pirelli's reserve unit had been called up in 04, and he'd come back in 06, with a bad knee and a worse attitude, and he wouldn't sit with his back to the door either. Coffee and pie? Asked Marie from behind the counter as Sean passed, and Sean nodded. There was a time when Marie wouldn't serve her, much less smile, back when Sean had the only black face in the county. Things had changed since then, some for the worst, it was true, but some for the better as well. There was a coffee in front of Wakefield already, light beige like he'd poured in 4 or 5 of the little half-and-half containers on top of the milk. Marie added, unless you said otherwise. He looked pale against the green paint on the wall behind him, his eyes sunken. Under the fluorescence, Sean could see his eyes were light, a greeny-brown contrast with his dark hair and olive skin. The pie's good, she said, shrugging out of her jacket and piling it on the bench next to her. You should try it. Most days she didn't indulge. The way her body'd started hanging on to calories like a famine was just around the corner. But she'd run Boris at dawn and it was turning cold outside. There would be frost by morning and maybe snow by Halloween. It had happened before. Wakefield shrugged as Marie brought Sean's coffee and a fat wedge of apple pie. Would you like anything? Marie asked, but he just shook his head and she took herself off with a pointed look at Sean. Sean rolled her eyes and looked back to see Wakefield watching, eyes narrowed. Let me guess, he said, flicking his gaze towards the counter where Marie was thumping unnecessary glassware. You're dating her brother. With some humor in his face, he might be cute. At that moment, he was just too intense to be comfortable. If this was what hunters were like, no wonder Canthy hadn't had much to do with them. Not quite, Sean admitted. Though everyone knew Mike since he'd been the deputy chief of police in Monroe for 3 years and on the force for 8 before that, ever since he came back from Iraq the first time. So tell me again, what are you looking for? He nodded briskly. I need a doorway, he said, turning his coffee cup in place, his gaze focused on a spot a dozen miles from the formica he was staring at. There's some place I need to go. Sean took a bite of pie. The diner was pretty quiet, just Mike's partner, Henry, sitting at the counter and Marie bustling around the kitchen making cleaning up noises. Wakefield's jaw worked and he turned his mug around again. Sean sighed. She really didn't know why she'd agreed to help when he asked her. Maybe he wasn't really a hunter. Maybe he was just crazy. But he had Canthy's name, and the name Bobby Singer did ring a bell for Sean. Double L must have mentioned him at some point. Where do you need to go? She asked after swallowing. He didn't get a chance to answer. Instead, he looked up sharply as the bell at the door jingled. Sean turned her head to see Mike approaching. Unzipping his uniform parka, he nodded at Henry but kept coming, stopping at Sean's shoulder. Boris is getting mud all over the back of the truck, Mike said, tugging softly at one of Sean's braids. When he let it go, the bead ticked softly against the others. Took him out to Cornfielders again? She shrugged, not willing to get into it. Mike knew there was something going on. He had to. He was the one who had taken her to Sisters of Providence after the Black Dog. But he'd never asked more than she was willing to tell. He needed a good run, she said, and nodded across the table. Mike, Sam Wakefield. Sam, Mike Pirelli. Nice to meet you, said Mike, eyeing Wakefield with a placid face that Sean knew concealed a bone-deep skepticism. That your Chevy out front? It's in great shape. Thanks, said Wakefield. It's my dad's. His hands had dropped beneath the table, and while he smiled at the compliment, his shoulders had gone stiff under the grimy gray T-shirt. Sam was looking for Canthy, said Sean, trying to find some way to blunt the tension. She knew his friend, Bobby, right? Bobby Singer, said Wakefield, with a nod. He'll be sorry to hear of her death. He told me... He hesitated, then continued. She was good people. Sean wondered exactly what Singer had to say about Canthy, probably something about her New England stubbornness and reserve. Mike's face eased a bit, his right hand dropping away from his belt. Canthy was, well, there's no one else like her. Thank God, muttered Sean, just to be difficult, and was surprised to see a flash of recognition in Wakefield's face as Mike chuckled. Well, hey, I gotta do paperwork on that break-in at Barton's, so I'll see you later. Mike took a step back, brown eyes flickering from Sean's face to Wakefield's. Nice to meet you, Sam. Likewise, said Wakefield, and lifted his coffee cup to his lips as Mike headed for the door. So, he added, when the doorbell jangled as Henry and Mike went out into the rain, is he going to run my place? Mike was a good guy and a good cop, better than you'd think for a small town like Monroe. Sean poked her pie with a fork, appetite fading. Why, you got something to hide? Wakefield shifted, his gaze going from the door to Sean and back again. Hunters can't always stay on the right side of the law, you know. There's more out there than gummaroos and furry dinosaurs. Like? But he shrugged and ignored the question. Can you tell me how long weird stuff has been happening out under those power lines? How far does the area extend past where I saw you? Sean sighed, sat back in her seat, and stared at him for a long moment. He didn't say anything, just met her eyes, with a look of flat curiosity, giving nothing away. Fine, then. Besides, he was apparently one of the good guys, and information wasn't going to hurt anyone. Marie, can I get another cup of coffee? After that first meeting, an hour of Wakefield picking her brains over cooling coffee, Sean didn't see him at all, but he was clearly still in town. He called her twice, once at 3 a.m. to ask her for details about what he called the well, out under the power lines. She suspected he was sleeping in his car, since Mike reported rousting him from the railroad overpass before dawn 4 days later. "Guy's kind of a nut," Mike grumbled, flipping pancakes in the old-fashioned farmhouse kitchen on Saturday morning a few days before Halloween. As predicted, the weather had turned cold, and there was a dusting of snow outside the window. "He's gonna be trouble." "Has he done anything illegal?" Sean asked from the fridge, where she was looking for the jug of homemade maple syrup. "Nothing worth charging him with." Mike looked positively disappointed about that. He'd run both the name and the plates, but nothing had come up on either. "Wish you'd stay clear of him," he added, "but without heat." They gave each other space. It was why they worked as well as they did. She didn't ask about his cases, and he didn't ask her about her special projects. Somehow he could tell that Wakefield fell into that category, so he mostly held his peace. The pancakes were excellent, hot and studded with blueberries from the farm, berries that Sean had washed, dried, and frozen back in July. How her mother would have laughed to see Lashandra cooking down maple sap and baking her own bread. Sean, who would eat nothing for breakfast but the brightest colored cereals, all chemicals and sugar. But Theora Mason wasn't likely ever to know her youngest ran a farm in northern New Hampshire, not if Sean had anything to say about it. Sean had just gotten up to clear the table when Mike's cell rang, that rat-tat-tat that meant a call from the station. "Pirelli," he answered, and then, "When?" "Uh-huh. Okay. Get with Henry and establish a perimeter. I'll be there in 15. When he tucked the phone back in his pocket, his face was creased with concern. Sean didn't ask, but he told her anyway. "Jam Parker's little boy is missing. Went out to make a snowman this morning, and..." There was nothing Sean could say to make that better, so she poured the last of the coffee into a travel mug and sent him off, feeling as useless as the women in those old movies. The Parkers lived on the edge of town, nowhere near the cornfielders or the power lines, which made this likely a police matter, not a supernatural one. But maybe it would be better to be sure. Sean piled the dishes in the sink and whistled for Boris. Sean had been busy the last few days, selling the last of the previous winter's pottery to a few end-of-season tourists who found their way to the farm, and doing a long-delayed clearing out of the shed behind the kennels. That had meant 3 runs to the country recycling center and no time to take Boris up to the power lines. When she came out of the woods into the open, she realized maybe that had been a mistake. Something was different, something more than the chill wind and the patchy unmelted snow clinging to the shady spots and the roots on the shrubs. Boris wouldn't run loose, but made anxious orbits around her, his hackles raised. Shotgun in hand, Sean paced uneasily into the field, watching carefully for something out of place. There was nothing, though. Just the wind rattling the dead leaves, trails slick with mud and rotting vegetation, the cry of some late departing geese overhead. But her skin prickled, her nerves jumpy as she turned into a slow circle. She caught the whiff of a familiar odor in the air, redolent of the paper mill in Berlin. Sulfur. She could see nothing, though, no evidence that anything was here other than herself and Boris, his whining nearly constant now. Even the tracks in the mud looked old, she thought, crouching down in the lee of a huckleberry bush, except she looked closer. That was a very large boot print, bigger than hers by several inches, even bigger than Mike's. Maybe the right size for someone as tall as Sam Wakefield, though. The mud had dried and crumbled in the last few days, the edges of the prints smeared and worn by later traffic, so Sean couldn't follow Wakefield's trail precisely. But as she moved south along the power line, she spotted his prints on one side of the trail under the oaks west of the towers. When she'd gone 100 yards without spotting them, she doubled back and picked him up again on the edge of a small, cleared space, the spot a favorite of the Monroe High students on summer nights. In the center of the clearing was a heap of blackened logs and cold gray ash, evidence of teenage parties fueled by boredom and skunked Molson, swiped from basements across the county. About the dead bonfire was an area of ground trampled far more recently, though. As Sean squatted to look more closely at the prints, her eyes caught a glimmer of something in the sunlight that wasn't snow or a broken beer bottle, and then more. In a curving line, she wet her finger and picked up a grain to test, but she knew before it touched her mouth that Sam Wakefield had laid a salt line out here. Canty hadn't left much of a library. She never was one for book research, even after they decided that they needed to know more about the hauntings and the critter attacks around the county. So she had a dozen or so hard-bound books, some of them moldy with age, on the shelf above her desk, and three file folders full of newspaper clippings, notes from phone calls, and the occasional letter from one of her far-flung contacts. Happily, she'd gotten into the habit of printing out her email because the power went out so often in the winter. The sun was glaring through the living room windows as Sean pawed through the files, teeth gritted. She tried calling Wakefield three times. Each time it just rang and rang, as if he didn't even have voicemail on his phone. Who didn't have voicemail? And what the hell was he up to anyway? Canty's notes weren't anywhere near comprehensive, but on a stained scrap of graph paper, there was a scribble mention of sulfur. Demons. Black eyes. Smoke. Sulfur. See Rituale Romanum. And then a name. B. Singer. And a number. This must be the Bobby that Wakefield had mentioned. It was true. He had been in touch with Canty at some point. The question was, would Singer talk to Sean? Would he know what Wakefield was doing, what the sulfur meant? Before she began to dial, her phone rang. Sean, it's me. Do you know where your pal Sam is? Mike's voice was clipped, anger just held back. No, she admitted. And he's not exactly a pal either. Why? Between Wakefield's behavior and the salt line, she knew something was off about him, but she was still surprised when Mike said, "Someone saw that black Chevy of his near the Parker's place this morning. If he called, get its location. I don't care how." "I will," she said, and he hung up without saying another word. Son of a bitch. Sam Wakefield was looking less and less like an ally against the dangers of the unnatural. It was clear that Mike and Sean would have to talk about what she did when she went out to the power lines, but first she was going to call this Bobby Singer. It was more than 24 hours before Singer returned her call, hours full of anxiety and rumor, as the locals turned out in force to hunt for the little Jordan Parker. There was no sign of Wakefield, not even at the power lines, nor anywhere else Sean associated with supernatural occurrences. He'd gone to ground so well that not even the combined sheriff's department of Monroe and Sunder counties could find him. Sean was tramping through Bester's Woods on a straight line, 10 yards from Marie on one side and Mike's cousin Francine on the other, when her cell rang. She fisted out of her pocket without stopping. "Miss Mason, this is Bobby Singer. I'm sorry I took such a long time to get back to you." Keeping her voice low, Sean circled around a patch of poison ivy and returned to her line. "You sent this Wakefield guy to me, Singer, and Canty knew you, so I'll give you the benefit of the doubt." There was a pause on the line. "There a reason I need that benefit, ma'am?" "How likely is it that your pal Sam would kidnap a 5-year-old kid, Singer? And why do I smell sulfur when I go looking for him?" "You think he did what?" The shock in Singer's voice was undisguised, and Sean's shoulders loosened. She dropped her voice even lower. "Jordan Parker went missing yesterday morning, and that old Chevy was seen nearby. What's he doing? Would he do that?" Another long pause hung on the line. "Christ, I'm sorry, ma'am, but I don't know any more. Where are you again?" "Monroe, New Hampshire." "And don't act so surprised. Wakefield says you sent him here." The shadows were falling fast. They had maybe another hour of light left. It was Halloween night, and Jordan Parker wasn't going to be trick-or-treating this year. In fact, nobody was. In the aftermath of the kidnapping, the selectmen had canceled it. Any kids out on the street, in costume or not, would be escorted home. "He might have got your information from me, but I haven't talked to him in months." Which didn't actually answer Sean's question. Perhaps Singer was slyer than she'd first thought. On the other hand, he was the only source of information she had at the moment. "There's a spot out under the power lines here where a lot of creatures show up. Nasty shit. Black dogs. Last year, 3 ghouls. That sort of thing. Wakefield's been out here a couple times, and he picked my brains for everything I knew about it. But he wouldn't say why." There was a heavy sigh through the speaker. Shit. Sean was coming near the end of her line. She'd have to cut this off before she rejoined the other searchers. "Tell me, man." Singer's answer, when it came, was heavy and slow, burdened with reluctance and worry. "Your spot sounds like a doorway, maybe an honest-to-God devil's gate, and Sam wants to use it to go to hell." "Jesus. And Jordan?" But Sean was afraid she already knew the answer. I can't say for sure. If Sam took him, Singer hesitated. I don't know. Could be just a coincidence, but if he did, that boy's either the bait to open the door or he's the sacrifice to make it happen. Sean had never met Jordan Parker, but for 5 years she traded his mother syrup for eggs and fresh tomatoes. She couldn't imagine looking Jan Parker in the eye now, knowing what she knew. So she stopped in the shadow of the trees as the other searchers converged on the rendezvous point. They wouldn't find him this way. She gripped the phone so hard her hand began to cramp. How do I stop him? Lots of holy water should do it, said Singer. Stop the ritual anyway. And if it doesn't? Damn stuff only worked about half the time, as far as Sean could tell. Singer sighed. Do what you have to, but try not to kill him. He's one of the good guys. Then you sure have a fucked up way of defining good, Singer, Sean said and snapped the phone closed. That crazy mother was opening a gate to hell on her watch. So, Mike came out of the bathroom, a smear of white toothpaste on his lip. Sean shooed Boris out the door, knowing he'd sneak back in later, and they'd wake to shaggy gray and black hair all over their comforter. What? She asked, peeling her socks off and tossing them in the laundry basket. Her feet got hot at night, even now that the weather had turned cold. But it wasn't fair to play ignorant, no matter how tired she was, so when Mike snorted, "You know, Sean." She nodded and sat down on the bed. She rubbed her eyes with her palms, then dropped her hands down to her lap, picked at the drawstring on her pajama pants before looking up again. Remember that time I got cut up last year, and when Boris tangled with a bear up on Tumbledick Mountain? She looked straight at him, really looking, for once, at the olive skin and somber eyes, the way his hair was graying and needed to be cut, the lines around his mouth that he'd brought back from Iraq. She'd known him for 15 years, and they'd been lovers for 6. If anyone was going to trust her without proof, it was Mike Pirelli. Yeah, he said uncertainly, waiting for the other shoe to drop. He pulled back the covers and settled into bed, but left the light on. What has this got to do with Wakefield and Jordan Parker? Jordan Parker was still missing. Sam Wakefield was still missing. Sean couldn't bring herself to watch the television or listen to the radio. Maybe if Mike knew the truth, he could help find Wakefield. But Sean figured the chances were better he would just walk out the door. It wasn't a dog bite or a bear, she said. She pulled up the sleeve of her t-shirt to show the scar she'd carried since 1991, the year they learned that, yeah, salt really was preferable to lead shot. I got this from a ghoul that was going after school kids over in Dixieville. Took 3 rounds of rock salt from the 870 to take it down. When he didn't say anything, just nodded up his forehead, she tapped her right knee. About 10 years ago, I wrenched this knee, was on crutches for a couple months. I said, one of the dogs knocked me down. It wasn't. It was a poltergeist on the back porch at Wentworth's B&B. We had to bless the place with holy water and sage 7 nights running, and on the 6th night, it got pissed off. Mike leaned back against the headboard, his arms crossed against his chest. So, you're a Ghostbuster. His voice was flat, neither sincere nor incredulous, withholding judgment. Other folks call us hunters, but yeah. Us, you said? Kanthi did this too? She learned it from her mom and her uncle, Al. She taught me. Hunting, dogs, sugaring, and even, in her reserved and reticent way, love. 5 years gone, and Sean still missed her every day. She let it show as she glared at Mike, but then Mike loved Kanthi too. Said she was the least crazy of all the Pirellis, but he might change his mind on that now. He thought that over, eyes hooded for a while, long enough for Sean's feet to get cold on the old oak flooring, so she tucked them up underneath herself, pulling at the comforter to cover her. Finally, he shrugged, dropping his arms. Assuming Sean wasn't crazy or lying was what he meant. What's Wakefield got to do with it? He's a hunter, too. But there's a spot out behind Kornfelder's, under the high-tension lines, and it's weird. Creatures show up there, stuff you've never seen before. Other things, too. To her surprise, Mike was nodding. We found some bodies dumped out there. You're saying they maybe weren't dumped? Maybe. Anyway, Wakefield, he wants something out there. Wants to open a door to somewhere, somewhere bad. How? Canthy had always said not to sweat the theory, so long as they knew how to kill something, but here, they needed to know the whys and the wherefores, and they had shit. Sean had camped out behind Kornfelder's place for the last 36 hours and seen nothing, heard nothing, even the smell of sulfur was gone. I don't know, she admitted. So what do you do now? She flopped back onto the bed and stared at the ceiling. Sleep for 6 hours and go back out there. I don't know what else I can do. Right. Mike took his cell phone off the nightstand. Patrice, this is Mike. I need a cruiser out on Belknap Lane off 197. You know the turnout where the kids go partying under the power lines. Someone saw Wakefield's old Chevy out there, but I didn't get the word until now. Yeah, I don't know, but I'll take anything. Yeah. Yeah. I am. I'll see ya. Yeah. Bye. The phone clicked against his watch as he laid it down. You believe me? She hadn't really expected it. It was crazy, after all. If a kind of crazy she'd been living with for 20 years. The bed dipped as he moved closer, and he tugged on one braid softly, so she turned her head to look at him. Upside down, he was suddenly unfamiliar. But his voice was the same as always, gravelly and soft. I don't not believe you. It would explain a lot about my family history. I admit, crazy runs in the family. Don't know about crazy, but he looked away. Service does, one way or another. Warmth swept through her. She reached up and tugged at his shoulder until he folded down next to her. Love you, she said, and curled into him, pressing against him until he wrapped one arm around her and used the other to turn out the light. Mike was out the door at dawn, pausing only to hug her briefly. Keep in touch, he said, arms warm around her. Then he was gone. Sean fed the dogs, pulled on long johns under fleece-lined jeans, and whistled Boris into the truck. It was clear but chilly, frost laced across her windshield and crackling under her boots. On the way through town, she stopped at Marie's with her thermos for coffee and a couple of sandwiches. As she waited at the counter, two trucks went by with the seal of the Forest Service on the doors. They're searching off the logging roads up Deer Ridge, said Marie, filling Sean's thermos. That poor boy. He must be so cold. Sean could only nod. Cold was the least of it, and the bleak look on Marie's face showed she knew it too. When Sean pulled out her wallet, Marie just waved her off. Go find him, she said. There wasn't a cruiser or any kind of car at the turnout when Sean got to Belknap Lane. She pulled off, chewed on her lip a moment, and then pulled back onto the road. About a half mile up the way was a grown-over driveway leading to a house that was abandoned after the foundation was laid. Sean forced the truck 30 yards in, wincing at the branches scraping along its sides, and then pulled into the shadow of two white pines. She was taking a risk, she knew. If Wakefield showed up and then ran, she wouldn't be able to chase him, but she was more worried he'd spot the car and disappear for good. And she had her cell phone, and the 870, and Boris. She wasn't alone. Besides, chances were he wouldn't be back. It was just the only lead she had. There was a blanket in the back of the truck, liberally covered with dog hair. Sean slung it over her shoulder and, whistling Boris to heel, went looking for a place to set up her watch. Twigs and grass, stiff with frost, crackled under her feet as she struck cross-country towards the fire pit where Wakefield had set his salt line. Boris bounding around her and occasionally racing off at an angle. It was going to be a long day. Wakefield didn't show until after dark, but sunset fell so early this late in the year, Sean was only beginning to think about eating the last of her sandwiches when she heard someone moving in the bushes. She looped Boris's line about the tree next to her and put a hand on his muzzle to keep him silent as she peered in the darkness. Her eyes had adjusted to the darkness, so the silver of the moon above the horizon provided enough light for her to see Sam Wakefield push a branch aside and step into the clearing. He was a little more than a tall, broad-shouldered shadow, but his arms were full and he was here, where he shouldn't be. When she turned on a flashlight, he stopped in place, not moving.
Sean pitched her voice clear and loud. Put him down, right here. Wakefield stood in the flashlight's glare, his arms full of limp five-year-old. His hair was lank, his face dirty and scratched. Maybe Jordan had fought back. But if he had, he wasn't fighting now. The way his head lolled over Wakefield's arm, sleeping or drugged, Sean guessed. One hand, Sean racked the shotgun. He twitched, but he didn't let go of Jordan. The boy didn't move at all, drugged then. "You heard me," she said. "Put him down and step away." To her amazement, Wakefield shook his head. "No." He just stood there, holding the boy, brow furrowed. "I won't hurt him. I need him. You have to let me. It'll be okay." "Jesus," Sean snapped. "It's not going to be okay, because whatever it is, you're not going to do it." And she propped the flashlight in the V of the branch and took a step forward, wishing she brought the rifle instead of the shotgun. She couldn't take a shot without risking Jordan. She hadn't figured on Wakefield being so fast. Big, she knew, but she hadn't expected quickness from someone a good foot taller than her. He had Jordan in both arms when he walked into the clearing, but between one breath and the next, Jordan was tucked under his left arm, face smashed against Wakefield's shirt, while the other hand Wakefield held a .45 on her. "Don't push me," he said, brow furrowed. "I've shot hunters before, you know. Hell, I shot my dad and my brother," he added with a twisted smile. "Your dad in the habit of taking five-year-olds hostage, too?" John asked sourly. Boris whined. She wondered how long it would take him to chew through the lead. Too long, probably. She'd never shot a person before. She wasn't sure she wanted to start, and the boy was too close anyway. Wakefield took a smooth step sideways, keeping the gun on Sean and putting Jordan on the ground. "He's not a hostage," he said from a crouch. He shrugged a backpack off his shoulder and onto the ground next to Jordan. As Sean turned to follow him, he swiveled, keeping the gun trained on her. "I just need him here, that's all. Just until I get the gate open. And then he gets eaten by whatever comes out of the gate. No deal." One-handed, Wakefield opened the backpack and withdrew what looked like a handful of dried grass or weeds. But as Sean's words penetrated, he hesitated, closing his hand around the grass. "I guess. That wouldn't work, would it?" He looked up at Sean. "You take him home after I open it, then." Flatly, as if the logic were obvious. She cracked an astonished laugh in spite of herself. "Forgetting about the kidnapping?" He snorted, the limp hair on his forehead fluttering, and tossed the grass into the cold fire pit. "You really don't get it, do you?" When Sean just raised her eyebrows, he sank back on his haunches. "Look, I have to get into hell, and I can't get there without the gate, and I can't get the gate open without power, and to get the power, I need the kid. I'm not going to hurt him, I swear." He looked down at Jordan and touched the boy's face. Sean didn't realize until he looked back up at her that she'd missed her shot. "Damn it. And then we'll come back, and the gate closes, and I'll take him home." Sean remembered that Wakefield's eyes were lighter than you'd think, hazel in the daylight. From here, all she could see were dark pits, with little sharp glints where they reflected the dimming illumination of the flashlight. "That's assuming you actually come back from hell." She couldn't believe she was listening to this. On the other hand, she killed a ghoul a mile from here 6 weeks ago. How is a gate to hell weirder than that? "How does a five-year-old give you power?" He hesitated. "I use him to call a demon. When it gets here, I bind it and use its power to open the gate so I can go through." Jesus, he was serious. "Can stuff come out of the gate while you're gone? Haunts, ghosts, ghouls?" Her skin went cold. Things were bad enough already. "Harpies, incubi, ifrits, elementals," he shifted his weight. "More demons." God almighty, he was insane. "You were going to leave this kid here with God knows what and open a gate to hell. 6,000 people live in this county, Wakefield. Are you insane?" He shook his head, looking away from her. "I have to." Sean leveled the shotgun. "I don't care. I'm not letting you do it." Wakefield still had the .45 in one hand, while the other rested on his backpack. Jordan lay on his side, a foot or so away, not far enough out of range for Sean's comfort, but she was pretty sure she couldn't afford to wait. "Now put the gun," she began to ask, and then stopped as Wakefield looked over her shoulder, his eyes widening. "Oh, fuck." She spun on her heel, stepping back and raising the 870, but keeping an eye on Wakefield. It wasn't a feign. There was a flashlight bobbing toward them. The beam of light touching on Jordan still sleeping, Sean, Wakefield, before flicking upwards. The face it illuminated looked ghastly, pale and horrific in the extreme light until she recognized it and relaxed. Letting the barrel of the shotgun sink towards the ground, it was Mike who strolled into the clearing, one hand resting on the butt of his pistol. "Got tired of waiting for you to come home," Mike said easily, but his eyes didn't leave Wakefield. "Everything okay here?" "Jordan's okay," Sean said, unsettled by his calm. She'd found both the lost child and the man the entire county had been hunting for the last 48 hours. She opened her mouth to speak, and then Mike stepped up next to her, and before she had time to react, he had the shotgun out of her hands and pointed it at her. He looked completely calm, the shotgun in one hand and the flashlight in the other, beamed fixed on Wakefield. "Trying to renege on our deal, boy? I don't think so." The voice was Mike's, but not the tone, not the oily way the words came out of his mouth, not the way there wasn't any white in his eyes anymore. Sean stayed very still, cold crawling down her back like dripping water. "That's not your boyfriend," said Wakefield unnecessarily. He stayed where he was, eyes locked on Mike's face. "That's the demon. Sukarbanoth." "And that's who?" Sean was strangely proud that her voice was even. "I'm the guy who's going to blow your head off if you don't shut up," said the demon to Sean in Mike's voice. "Wasn't planning on reneging," said Wakefield cautiously. He stayed where he was, one hand in the dirt around the fire pit and the other on the backpack. Jordan was curled on his side on the ground, almost unnoticeable in uncertain light. "I was gonna call you as soon as I got things together." "Right," sneered the demon. "Like I should wait for that. I heard about you Winchesters. You only make deals when you think you can break 'em." Wakefield's mouth tightened, and he shook his head. "I know better. Besides, if you know who I am, you know why I need your help. So not Wakefield, but Winchester." He met Mike's eyes evenly, then looked away, matching Sean's gaze with enough intensity that she could tell he was trying to tell her something. "So let's get it going, then," said the demon, not moving the shotgun from where it rested against Sean's jacket. "But I want to be paid first." He looked at the shadows next to Winchester, where Jordan was, and the hunger on his face raised the hairs on Sean's neck. Even without the other evidence, Sean would have known this wasn't her lover. He never looked like that before. "All right," said Winchester, shifting his weight to stand up, and Sean began to worry that maybe he was going to give Jordan to the demon. Even though he'd said the boy was only bait, hadn't he? The demon, Suker something, shoved the flashlight into Sean's hands, commanding her, "Hold that on the kid, bitch," before stepping away from her, his eyes on Jordan, the shotgun, however, he kept pointed on Sean. The flashlight was Mike's, from his cruiser, heavy and solid. It would make a good weapon if Sean weren't 18 inches away from the muzzle of her own Remington 870. Still, between that and the increased room to move, she might be able to do something, assuming she got the chance. That chance came barely 2 seconds later. With an enraged snarl, Boris exploded from the brush behind the demon, all of his 120-pound weight cannoning into Mike's back. The ragged end of the leash he'd chewed through trailed behind him. Boris had been trained to hunt from a line of dogs Canthy had hunted with for 30 years, and yet Sean had never seen him so enraged. The snarl on his face exposed his canines clear to his gums, and his hackles were raised the entire length of his spine. He was barely recognizable as the dog who shed long gray guard hairs all over the sofa in the farmhouse. The demon was taken completely by surprise. Knocked forward by Boris's attack, he put up his hands to break his fall, and the shotgun went flying, but he couldn't stop his fall completely. He ended up face down in the dirt, Boris standing on his back as Sean scooped up the shotgun. "Good dog," said Winchester, and grabbing the flashlight, cracked it across the back of the demon's head. The demon slumped forward, chest flattening to the ground. Sean got the shotgun settled, unsure where to point it, at Mike or at Winchester. "Isn't he unconscious?" Sean asked, as Winchester pulled a length of cord from around his backpack. She whistled Boris away, and he came to her side, hackles still raised and continuing to growl at an almost inaudible level. Not for long, Winchester began lashing the cord around Mike's wrists, muttering as he did so. Within 2 minutes, Mike was trussed like one of Chief Shelton's 4th of July pigs, and just in time, because as Winchester checked the last knot, Mike's body arched, rolled over, and sat up. There were scratches on his face, and his eyes were still black. "Don't bother," said Winchester, as the demon wrenched at his bonds, and they stilled, hissing with pain. "Those ropes are woven with silver and steel and soaked with holy water. You're not getting out until I release you." "What? No exorcism?" the demon challenged, and then smiled, flickering his tongue out to lick at the blood on his face. "But you still need me, don't you, Winchester? Daddy's little scholar, and you still don't know enough to get where you want to get. Bet you wish you'd taken that bitch up on her offer now, don't you?" Winchester's face hardened. "Yeah, I need you, but I don't need you whole." Taking a flask from the backpack, he splashed the demon in the face. There was a hiss, and the demon roared, writhing. "What are you doing?" Sean stepped forward, holding the shotgun ready, but not yet aiming it at anyone. "That's still Mike in there, isn't it?" "For now," confirmed Winchester, his voice hard, then dropped to his knees and dug into the backpack again. This time he brought out a container of salt and a plastic bag full of what looked like loose tea. "But I've seen a demon keep a corpse animated for months after the host dies. He's got no incentive to be nice to—" He hesitated, hands stilling from the plastic bag. When he spoke again, his voice had changed again. It was the more sociable tone he used when they first met. "I'm sorry, I've forgotten your friend's name." "Mike Pirelli," she said, and laid a hand on Boris's head. She could feel him growling, the vibration thrumming through his skull and upper arm. "Right," confirmed Winchester, and began to draw lines in the dirt with the salt forming circles around the fire pit and the demon. "Sukar Benoth doesn't care if Mike lives or dies, so that gives him an advantage if he gets free." Sean watched him, glancing occasionally at the demon, who sat hunched over his bonds in the center of the circle. It reminded her of something the demon had said. What did he mean about an exorcism? There were now 3 lines of salt around them and the fire pit. Winchester started drawing symbols in the dirt with the tea leaves, or with whatever they were. He didn't look up at her as he said, "Sometimes you can exorcise the demon, free the host. It's not a pleasant process." "Sometimes." The shotgun was cold in her hands. She didn't want to think about what Mike must be going through, trapped inside his own body, inside his own mind. Unable to move or speak, to do anything, he wouldn't mind an unpleasant process if it freed him. Winchester looked up at her, and for a flicker of a second, he looked like his eyes were black. Then he shifted his position, and it was just shadows again. "The host doesn't always survive an exorcism. He'll be better off if we go through with the deal." He glanced quickly towards the demon, then jerked his head towards Jordan, still sleeping a few yards away. What was he trying to tell her? What couldn't he say when the demon was here, listening to everything? "Wait a minute. Go through with the deal. Oh, no you don't. Just because—" She wasn't prepared for the blank determination in Winchester's face when he raised his head from the symbols he was drawing. "Yes, I do. Because if I don't, I won't free your boyfriend. And I'm his best chance. Have you ever performed an exorcism, Miss Mason?" "Fuck." "It's better this way," continued Winchester, not even looking at her as he applied dabs of dark ointment to his wrists and eyelids. "You can guard the gate. Make sure nothing comes through while I'm gone." "Better," repeated Sean, the words sour in her mouth. If she shot Winchester down right now, she'd still have a demon on her hands, and she couldn't keep Mike bound indefinitely. How much damage could a demon do as a cop? Probably a lot. And the demon might kill her before she found a way to free Mike. This was wrong. She looked down at Mike, trapped and silent in his own flesh, and thought, despairing, no. If it were just Mike alone, he'd say shoot Winchester and be done with it. But it wasn't just Mike. Or Jordan. It was 6,000 people in Monroe County, and more after that, goddammit. "Okay, we're set," Winchester squatted next to the fire pit, a worn leather journal propped open on one knee and a lighter in his hand. "Once the gate opens, I'll need you to guard it. If I'm gone too long, you can shut it down. Just douse the fire with the holy water." He lit a curl of paper from his pocket and used it to light the tinder he layered under the stack of loose wood and dried herbs. Smoke curled upwards immediately, smelling more of incense and the musk of the old books than of burning vegetation. Sean pressed her lips together, squashing the rage. How long is too long? And what about them? She nodded to the demon and the child. If I'm not back in 2 hours, I'm not coming. The salt line should combine anything that comes through. Keep the line solid, and you should be fine. There's more salt in the box, and there's a copy of Rituale Romanum in the journal, if you need it. You have salt rounds for the shotgun? When she nodded, he stood up, looming suddenly over the demon. Right. Wish me luck, he said with a flashing grin that transformed his face, and laying one hand on the demon's head, began to chant. It wasn't a language Sean recognized, not Latin or Romance language or Loatian, which she knew only from hearing it in the produce aisle at the grocery store. Whatever it was rolling from Winchester's chest like thunder, full of hard consonants and syllables smeared into one another. It made the darkness feel heavier somehow, the night colder. As he spoke, a green light began to gather around his hand where it lay on Mike's hair, a light that brightened and flowed hesitantly up Winchester's arm and across his chest. The demon shuddered, jerking as if trying to pull away, but Winchester's hand seemed glued to him. More and more light, energy, Sean realized, poured out of the demon and into Winchester. Gathering at last around his right hand, it pulsed and burned, almost too bright for Sean to look at. It was the fierce and glowing ball of green-white brilliance about a foot across. In the unhealthy luminescence, Winchester's face looked harrowed, and the tendons on his neck protruding as if he were pulling the power out of himself as well as the demon. Sweat poured down his face, despite the frigid air, and the hand on the demon's head began to shake. Boris was huddled against her, his growls turned into low whine. Sean backed up, the skin on her arms was prickling. She didn't know what she expected, but this wasn't it. Eyes not leaving the tableau of Winchester power demon, she dropped down next to Jordan, putting a hand on the sleeping boy's arm, whether to reassure herself or protect him, she couldn't say. Minutes passed, or no time at all, just light, and Winchester's voice rolling around the clearing, and he made a gesture as if throwing a baseball. The light flew from his hand into the air, and just above the fire, in the exact center of the circle, it splattered, as if there were a water balloon hitting the ground, and the ball of power exploded sideways, the green-white light flashing outwards into a brilliant vertical disk 10 feet in diameter, hovering in the air above the fire. Winchester stopped chanting. The sudden silence was as shocking as the gateway in the air. There was a groan from the demon, who slumped over sideways, his head almost touching Winchester's boots, but Winchester ignored him and checked the magazine on his .45 before slinging his backpack on. He didn't even look at Sean, or Jordan, or the demon, before taking two long steps and diving through the glowing green circle. "Luck," said Sean into the silence. The coffee in her thermos was long cold, but at least it was coffee. Sean swallowed it down and awkwardly closed the lid with one hand. She kept the shotgun in the other, never looking away from the gateway. She'd forgotten to check her watch, but she figured it was about an hour since Winchester went through. How long would it take for Winchester to do whatever it was he was meant to do? How long before something on the other side of that gate noticed it was there and came exploring? "You're screwed," croaked a voice, and Sean nearly jumped. The demon had been so silent she thought he'd passed out after the gate opened. "He's not coming back, you know." She shrugged, putting a quieting hand on Boris's back, who had snarled when the demon spoke. "So what if he doesn't?" "You don't really think you can close that gate, do you? Winchesters will tell you anything to get you to do what they want. It takes power to close that gate. And I'm the only one around here with any of that." There was a ripple in the green surface of the gate. Sean settled her weight onto both feet, readying herself, but then nothing happened, and she eased back onto her heels. "Like I'm gonna listen to you? Hey, I'm your only option, bitch." Something burst through the gate, something black and warped, about the size of Boris, too many limbs on its body, red eyes in its head. Sean fired again. It howled, hit the ground, and then she fired once more, and it stopped moving. "What the hell was that?" she demanded. The demon laughed, its voice raw. "That's just the beginning. You think Winchester cares about you or any of your people? You let him open a gate to hell. When he spoke again, his voice was wheedling, condescending in the way that always put Sean's back up. You don't know what he is, do you? Sean wanted that carcass out of here, but it was too big, and no way was she dragging it across the salt lines. It would have to wait. What do you mean? What did this demon know that she didn't? And just how long had it been since Winchester went through? When should she think about closing this thing down? Sammy Winchester is not like you or your pal here, the demon said. Sammy's not entirely human. He could be a power, downstairs, a prince, if he wanted. Why should he come back here? Shit. Had Winchester lied? Was he coming back, or was Sean just going to be stuck here, defending the unclosable doorway until finally she was overwhelmed by the evil flowing through? He seemed pretty human to me, she retorted. It was only an hour. She'd give him some more time. Winchester hadn't tried to hurt her, hadn't threatened her, not really. He did kidnap Jordan, though. He'd cut a deal with this demon-possessing Mike, was blackmailing her into helping him. Damn, damn, damn. Plenty of things look human, kiddo, said the demon. And that was exactly Mike's voice, exactly Mike's phrasing, and just exactly too much. Sean swung around, laying the butt of the shotgun against his head so hard, she knocked him over sideways. Shut up, she snapped, and ignored him when he just laughed into the dirt. Winchester, at least, hadn't possessed anyone. Nobody was hurt yet. Not past fixing, anyway. 10 minutes later, there was another ripple in the gate. Sean lifted the shotgun, ready to fire, as first one, then another figure came through. But the first one stumbled through the fire pit, towing the second behind him and yelling, "Don't shoot, it's me!" It was Winchester's voice, raw with exhaustion. He stumbled out of the fire pit and dropped to his knees in the dirt, hands still locked around the forearm of the second man. The second man took 3 steps out of the gate and fell on his face in the dirt. Winchester rolled him over and revealed that he was naked as a jaybird, smeared with blood and soot, and out cold. "Dean," said Winchester, shaking him by the shoulders. "Dean, we made it. You're out." Sean stared. He'd gone into hell to get someone out. Whoever Dean was, he was in poor shape, skeletally thin, and scored with burns, including vicious welts across his back and shoulders. She would have liked to help. She had a blanket she could offer, but as she turned to look for it, she realized that the gate was still open, and that the edges of the gate were warping and rippling, as if something too big for the opening had followed Winchester and was trying to get through. "Look out," she warned, and started shooting even before the surface of the gate was pierced by a long, snake-like tentacle. The next few minutes were never clear in her memory. Later, Sean remembered firing over and over, scrambling to reload the fingers that shook and fumbled. Swarms of tentacles emerged from the gate, soft like worms, but with an unerring strength and drive. Once one grabbed Boris, Sean freed him, and a blast of salt shot at a point-blank range. Twice something flew out of the gate, and she managed both times to bring him down. Canthy would have been proud. The second time, she was sure she heard the demon yell, "Pull!" behind her, with a crackling laugh. Winchester found a machete somewhere, and he waded in to close the gate, boots nearly in the fire, hacking away at it. "We need to close it," he shouted over his shoulder. "Holy water! We need the holy water!" There was holy water in Sean's pack, but Winchester couldn't reach it. She heard the demon laugh. Damn it, she dodged across the clearing, firing madly, and jumped over the salt lines into the brush to where she'd left her supplies. The pack was closed tight. Sean yanked at the zipper of the pack, one-handed, until the flap opened and all the equipment inside fell to the ground. Flask in hand, she turned back to the clearing. Winchester was surrounded, swinging the machete with the slow drag of exhaustion. Sean shoved the flask into her pocket and fired twice, enough to make the creature retreat a little. She was running out of ammunition. 2 more rounds and she'd have to reload, and she was pretty sure she only had 4 more after that. An enormous tentacle, bigger than any of the rest, emerged from the gate. This one was barbed, the tip dark and glittering as if metallic. It struck at Winchester, who dodged it with a rough cry, exposing Dean behind him, flat on the ground and utterly vulnerable. The tentacle pulled back, hesitated as if it had eyes and were searching for a target, and then coiled as if to strike again. Just as it began to lash forward, Sean yanked the holy water from her pocket and dashed the flask into the fire. There was a flash of light, this time bright white, with no green in it, a puff of rancid smoke, and then the gate was gone, as if it had never been there. Sean blinked. The sudden closing of the gate had dropped the clearing into darkness, lit only by a few coals still glowing in the fire pit. At some point, the flashlight had gone out. Sean wasn't even sure where they were anyway. "Is it gone?" she asked after a moment, as her eyelids adjusted slowly. "The gate's gone," gasped Winchester. "Got that," said Sean. "I actually meant the snake thing." There was a pause, shuffling sound, and then a thump as someone tripping and hitting the ground. "Well, most of it's gone," said Winchester. "Ow." Anyone else would look absurd trying to carry a man the size of Dean Winchester. Yeah, Sam's brother, which explained a lot, Sean thought, in his arms. But Sam Winchester was enormous, and Dean looked like he maybe weighed what Sean did. He was so skinny, so Winchester didn't have much trouble carrying him, especially since Dean hadn't woken since they put out the remains of the fire and packed up the gear. Winchester had bullied the demon into leaving Mike, and had only needed to read the first phrases of the exorcism ritual before Sugar Benoth departed, which was a sight Sean never wanted to see again. She wouldn't tell Mike what it looked like, the way his face and throat contorted as the demon spiraled into the midnight sky in a torrent of black dust. He didn't need to know that. In any event, he was confused but conscious and steady enough to carry Jordan back to the road, while Sean lugged her flashlight, pack, and weapons. It was about a quarter mile in the dark, leading Mike and Winchester through the brush and the woods, and it gave her time to think. "Okay," she said, when the glossy black paint of Winchester's Chevy came into the view and pumped the shotgun. "This is where you get off." "What?" Winchester swiveled, arms still full of his brother's weight. A branch caught him in the face, and wet maple leaves clung to his jacket. "I need to get him to a hospital. Make some calls. I don't know if he's..." Sean shook her head. "There's a hospital down Route 3 in Lancaster. Figure it'll take you about 40 minutes to get there." "But..." Winchester's forehead crumpled. "I don't..." "Oh." "Sean..." Mike chose that moment to let Jordan, who managed to sleep through everything, slide to the ground. In stark contrast to Jordan's peaceful rest, Mike looked baffled and frightened, and there was still blood on his face from when Winchester had clubbed him. Sean had known him for 15 years, and she'd never seen him look like that. Never seen him lost. The rage climbed up her chest and wound itself around her throat until she could barely breathe. She put a hand on Mike's shoulder, supporting herself, until she could trust herself to speak again. When she did speak, she made herself look at Winchester, but all she saw was Jordan's face, pressed against Mike's blood-smeared uniform. "You take yourself, and your demons, and your family. That's so much more important than anyone else's family. And get out.
Don't come back."
They didn't. End.